in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Today, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg joins us to talk about language and how language reflects the tenor of the times. Nunberg says if you listen carefully, you can learn a good deal about American culture and politics. Not that listening carefully to words is easy. Nunberg says one of the things that continues to perplex him, quote, after all these years of writing about words, is just how hard it is to attend to language and how much of it slips past you, however great an effort you make to listen critically. Words, he says, usually have something to hide. You have to shake them until the top pops off and some revelation tumbles out, an insight into some attitude that would be hard to put your finger on by any other means. Jeffrey Nunberg is a senior researcher at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. He's also a consulting full professor of linguistics at Stanford. He chairs the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. You may have heard our guest's essays on language on the NPR program Fresh Air. He's contributed essays on language for that program since 1989. He is also contributing features about language and topical issues for the Sunday New York Times. A collection of his essays on language titled Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times is now available from Public Affairs Press. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments on language for Jeffrey Nunberg. I look forward to your telephone calls. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Nunberg, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Well, how do you go about shaking words until their tops pop off?
Well, you know, there can be different ways. Often it happens that you've been hearing a word for, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, and you've never thought about it, and mm-hmm. suddenly you say, you hear it in some odd context, or it suddenly strikes you, you know, that's a word I never thought about before. I think it's mostly a question of being attentive.
Hmm. And what words have you been finding yourself paying attention to recently?
Well, in the last few weeks, of course, I've been listening to the language that people are using for the to describe what went on in Iraq, for example, in mm-hmm. Abu Ghraib prison. In fact, there's a piece today I did on Fresh Air about that. Mm-hmm. The European press are using torture for the most part. The British papers, both on the left and the right, the French, Italian, and German papers, they're all using that word. The American papers aren't using that word for the most part. It's abuse or mistreatment, maltreatment, something like that. And that was something that set me to being curious about those words.
Yeah. We had a guest on the morning telephone talk program, Focus 580, here this morning, who is an expert in international law.
Mm-hmm.
And she said all of the above happened, abuse, mistreatment, and torture.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and that's surely the case. And in fact, when you look at the Geneva Convention definition of torture, it's pretty broad. It allows any form of physical or mental mistreatment or the infliction of pain or suffering for any number of reasons to get information or a confession, to punish somebody, or just for some reason of discrimination. So probably by that definition, this would qualify as torture. But, I think Americans have been a little reluctant to use that word, partly probably because it sounds so damning, and a lot of people would like to extenuate what went on. But also, I suspect because those faces on those soldiers are so familiar, those pudding faces of middle class Americans that just don't seem like your image of a torturer. You think of Goldfinger, or Hannibal Lecter, or Vincent Price, one of these vaguely foreign, sophisticated, worldly figures, sociopaths. And these kids just didn't seem to have that look on their faces. It seemed like they were playing some other game.
Yeah. When you go about looking into words and word usage, say, for example, who's using the word torture in news stories, how do you do that?
Oh, forgive me. There are lots of ways of doing it. Of course, we have the web now, which has completely changed the way you think about language. It used to be that you'd have to comb through newspapers to find a few examples. Now you can just do a couple of clicks, and you've got thousands of examples of a word, or we've got all the back archives of newspapers online going back to the 19th century. And sometimes, you know, depending on the word, it's just a question of listening closely and not letting it just kind of pour in, but putting up a kind of screen that you try to be attentive to it. I'll give you an example. There's a piece, I think it's in this book, on like, that word that adults are always saying marks the decline of thought among American young people. A couple of years ago, we had one of those school shootings down in Southern California, and I was listening to the kids who were talking about the shooting and what had gone on and so forth. And they weren't particularly articulate kids. They were saying, and you know, and so forth. But none of them said like. None of them said, so I was like running for the door, or so he was like, we better get out of here. And it struck me that was very odd, because probably any half hour of speech with these kids, you'll hear them use the word, you know, dozens of times. And it struck me that it was an indication of that like has a certain function in their speech, which is to kind of impose a certain hip or flip, ironic distance between them and their remarks. And this was a context in which that really wasn't appropriate. And it showed that they can turn it off when it isn't appropriate to the circumstances. That was a question of hearing the absence of a word, which can be even trickier.
Mm. In that instance, what they had to say using the word like would get in the way of the import of what they were trying to tell you.
Right. They were really shaken up by what had gone on. And so the casual offhand irony that's implicit in like just wouldn't have been appropriate in that situation.
Yeah. That use of that word like, I was like, you know, it you can hear somebody's eyes rolling, as they say.
It's true, but it can also be a useful word. I mean, I use it in emails, for example, in a very studied way. I'll say something like, do you think we could, like, talk about it? and it does a certain work in sentences like that. Now, I think it does work in adolescent speech as well. It's a very good example of the importance of attending to what people are saying rather than just judging it, because if you think you're smarter than the English language, you're not going to hear what it's trying to say to you.
Yeah. In the introduction to this collection of essays, Going Nuclear, you say words can betray changing ideas and sensibilities. And liberty, you note, has been losing ground to freedom over the past 100 years.
Yeah, that's true. 100 years ago, or say at the time of the First World War, what we were fighting for was liberty. We had liberty bonds and liberty trucks, and liberty was the word that figured most prominently in patriotic propaganda. Not that freedom wasn't used, and particularly in the 19th century with regard to issues like slavery, but liberty was really the defining American virtue. And that changed. It began to change in Roosevelt's time when he brought forth the four freedoms, only two of which, freedom of religion and freedom of speech, could have been paraphrased with liberty. The other two, freedom from want and freedom from fear, really weren't ideas that you would express using liberty. It became a word, freedom, that was increasingly important both to the left and the civil rights movement. And then sometime around Reagan's time, it was taken over by the right. Reagan used it, I have the figures in the book, but there's something like 15 times in his second inaugural address, and only used liberty once. And right now, we're just fighting for freedom. President Bush says, the terrorists hate freedom, or he says, you see, the terrorists hate freedom. And he doesn't say they hate liberty. So freedom has kind of displaced liberty in the pantheon of American virtues. And in fact, liberty, when you hear it now, tends to refer to things like civil liberties. And there again, the right has been trying to take that word back from the left, which is where you mostly hear it nowadays.
Yeah. Well, maybe it is also because it sounds a little like the word liberal, which has fallen on hard times.
It has indeed. Liberal's a word that has really been transformed over the last half century or so. I saw a cartoon in the New York Times from 1955, I think, that showed a number of politicians all putting on liberal makeup, liberal face cream number two, liberal eyeshadow number three, at a time when everybody wanted to call himself a liberal. By now, it's a word that even people that we would call liberals are usually diffident about using. If you say, are you a liberal? They say, oh, I don't believe in labels, or something like that. And that's had a lot to do with the campaign to make liberal stand in not just for a set of political beliefs, but for a whole lifestyle, latte liberals, Chardonnay and Brie liberals, Volvo liberals, and so on. So if you look in the papers now, you see people almost never referring to working class liberals, black liberals, Latino liberals. You see those words used with conservative. But when you see liberal, there's almost always middle class around. It's basically a kind of middle class lifestyle rather than political doctrine. And for that reason, people are very chary about using it. That's one of the reasons why progressive has been making a comeback on the left, because people feel that liberal is just too compromised to use anymore.
Yeah, if you're liberal, you're not worth your salt.
Right.
Yeah. Jeffrey Nunberg is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. A collection of his essays about language is now available from Public Affairs Press. The title, Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments on words, on language, for our guest, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg. I look forward to hearing from you. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, as Going Nuclear is the title of this collection of essays, we should take a look at nuclear before.
Right. You should probably tell your listeners that it's actually spelled N-U-C-U-L-A-R, so they don't write letters to you saying, Celeste, you of all people should know how that word is pronounced.
Well, Going nuclear, I think they'd get it, especially the way I've been saying it. I hope so. Going Nuclear was a piece you wrote for Fresh Air, and it, of course, has provided the title for this collection of essays. You know, the president says, George W. Bush says, nuclear. So do a good many other people. The former head of the Illinois Department of Nuclear Safety pronounced the word nuclear.
Yeah, you know, in fact, that's something you hear a lot. I have an old friend who went to college with me and went on to do a Ph.D. at MIT in international relations and weapons and so on and so forth, and now is high up in a government agency dealing with nuclear power and nuclear energy. And I was talking to him, and I heard him say nuclear. I said, well, what are you saying nuclear? This is a word that you must have written or pronounced 10,000 times in your life. And he said, well, I just call it nuclear. I said, well, do you say nuclear medicine or nuclear family? He says, no, I would never say that. He says, I only say nuclear when I'm talking about nukes. So it's kind of, there are two reasons for saying nuclear. One's just a kind of mistake. It's not really a phonetic error. Nuclear isn't actually a hard word to pronounce. It isn't any harder than say, likelier is. But people who are unfamiliar with the word, and this was particularly the case when the word first became current in the 1950s, looked at it, didn't recognize it, and just assumed that it was pronounced like molecular or particular or something like that. And that explains the nuclear pronunciation that a lot of people had in those days and that you still hear among less educated people. When you hear a politician, a weapons specialist, someone in the Defense Department using that word, I think it's not, as I say in the piece, it's not a typo, it's a thinko. And it's a kind of deliberate, folksy pronunciation. In Bush's case, I call it a faux bubba pronunciation that signals a certain indifference to the way other people pronounce the word, as if to say, you know, we're the ones with our fingers on the button and we'll call them the bombs whatever we did well, please.
Mm. Well, I think, and I could be totally wrong about this, but I think with the former head of the Department of Nuclear Safety, the issue was for him to make nuclear less scary, nuclear. And he was heading an effort to site a low-level radioactive waste disposal facility.
That could very well be the case for some people. Certainly a lot of people, Les Aspin used to use it when he was Secretary of Defense and so on. But my sense is that for one reason or another, it's a pronunciation that if, even if it's the case of making trying to make people feel a little more reassured, it's a way of it's kind of a folksy pronunciation,
right,
as if to say, you know, I think of these things the way you do.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener. A caller on the toll-free line, line 4, listener in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. An interesting and, I think, timely discussion. When you were using the discussing political words such as liberty and liberal, my mind went to terrorism, and I think terrorism has sort of become like communism used to be. Whatever we don't understand or are afraid of, we use that generic label, and I think it, in my opinion, has justified a whole lot of extraordinary government power more than it needs to deal with the actual problem. What would your guest think of that idea?
I think that's absolutely right. In fact, there's a piece in this book about the history of that word, which has an extraordinarily complex and interesting history. It was used, it was used positively by people we would call terrorists until really the Second World War. In fact, the last group I found that called itself terrorist were the Stern Gang in Palestine, the Jewish terrorists who bombed the King David Hotel in what was in 1942. But after the war, it became associated with these movements of national liberation and so on, and it became a word that governments began to use in a pejorative way. And at that point, groups themselves stopped using the word. And Reuters, for example, won't use the word at all. I talked to a friend of mine who's a bureau chief at Reuters. He says, look, clearly what happened on 9/11 was terrorism, but once we use the word of that, then we have to make these choices. Was the ANC terrorist? How about the IRA? And so on. And we go down a slippery slope where there's no easy stopping off point. And you're also right that certainly in things like the USA Patriot Act, a wonderful acronym, terrorism is defined in a way that's enormously broad, that includes not just the sorts of acts that we would genuinely think of as terrorists, but if you break into a government computer system and do more than $5,000 worth of damage, I think that's it. That can count as terrorism, too. So it has this effect of just swelling to cover a whole range of actions that we may not disapprove of, or that may give us license to invoke extraordinary measures to combat them.
I think it's just a symptom of the inexact and politically manipulative use of language. I mean, freedom is another one, all sorts of things that this administration uses. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, what are your thoughts about the legislation that has been dubbed Patriot Act and the department that we have now since 9/11, Homeland Security?
Well, Homeland Security is a really extraordinary phrase. The word has been around in English homeland since the early 19th century, but it's not a word we ever apply to ourselves because it suggests a country defined by its physical attributes or by the people who live there rather than by a kind of political system. As I put it in a piece that touches on that word in this thing, we don't think of America as a country you come from. It's a country you come to.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very surprised when Homeland began to catch on after 9/11. And the fact that it's being used not just in the name of the department, but Bush is actually using it, we got to protect the homeland. And it's a strange and very disturbing, to my mind, shift in the language because it seems to be transforming American nationality into something more like the way we think about other nationalities, where really the nationality isn't defined around a set of political institutions and doctrines. It's rather defined just around coming from this particular place.
Hmm. And there's a sense to it that we've all got to be round pegs in round holes.
How do you mean?
That we're in this together. This is the homeland, and we are one people, and we're homogenous.
I think there's a lot of that in it, and in a funny way, this is something that's maybe more controversial. But I was disturbed at the idea of replacing the Star Spangled Banner with America the Beautiful. I have a piece on that here too, as well. And a lot of people say quite rightly that the Star-Spangled Banner is an impossible song to sing, and it becomes this little diva exercise at before a baseball game, rather than a song we can all join in on. But America the Beautiful, it seems to me, is a song that's about the physical presence of America. You know, the Purple Mountains, Majesties, and the Fruited Plains. It's also a song with a lot of adjectives in it. Too many adjectives. And it in that sense, it's very like the anthems of other countries, whether Syria or Switzerland or whatever, that extol the physical beauties of the place rather than either the political history of the place or the political ideals of the place. And to that extent, at least to the extent that anybody actually listens to the words of these things, it bothers me to think of it becoming our national anthem.
Hmm. Let's talk with some listeners. We're going to talk with a caller in Urbana on line one next. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Professor Nunberg, I always enjoy your little bits on fresh air. I have two questions for you today. First, I was hoping you could discuss why it is that people are now starting to use the plural processes rather than processes, which to me is more natural. And second, I was hoping you could discuss the evolution of weapons of mass destruction, which seems to be a term that wasn't even around more than 18 months ago, and now it's not only weapons of mass destruction, but it's even been reduced to WMDs and has become part of our everyday language. So I will hang up and listen.
Well, on processes or processes, it's interesting you pick that word. It's one of my bugbears. I just don't like to hear that. I mean, I understand a lot of people do it and they don't know any better and so on, but it's Latin, it's not Greek. And I think it's one of those words that people, I think it's something, at least in the way it got started, of an affectation about it. Although, I worked for many years in a high-tech research center, and everybody said processes, and it was one of those words you just roll your eyes and shrug and walk away. You don't bother to say anything. On WMDs or weapons of mass destruction, I think you're right. It's a phrase that has come in, and it's another one of these phrases that does the work of lumping together a lot of different things so that chemical weapons or poison gas and nuclear weapons all become in some way the same sort of thing, but different, say, from kind of traditional armament or traditional munitions that may in their way destroy as many people as those other weapons do, but aren't the sorts of weapons that we're liable to use. We have less need to use them because, after all, we've got big bombs. So I think there's some of that in the use of that phrase.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener. Line two, caller in Urbana. Hi.
Hello. Yes, you're talking about liberal and words such as that. So it's got me to thinking, and being a liberal myself, it seems like all the words from the left are getting either demonized or turned into words that are demonized. Or I don't know if that's the right word, but, have a bad connotation, or co-opted by the right. So I was wondering if you've noticed that there has been this trend for leftist terminology seems to be co-opted or destroyed by the right, and I can't really think of anything that the left has taken terminology from the right and gotten to be used or useful on the left, though that could be my bias. So I was just wondering about
Yeah,
that.
No, I think that's absolutely right. In fact, there are several pieces in this book that deal with that very process, whereby a word is introduced on the left, acquires a certain moral valence, and then is taken over by the right. I compare it to the way a company like Ford will buy a traditional brand name like Jaguar and try to sell it as a mid-market car, hoping that some of the luster will stick to it. And in fact, that's happened to a lot of words. Empowerment was one of the earlier words that this happened to, which began as a word of the civil rights movement and the feminist movement, and then was taken over by the right, people like Bill Bennett and Jack Kemp. Hate speech, a recent word. Now that, in the academic context, refers to speech that's particularly aimed at ethnicity or nationality or sexual orientation and so on. It's been used by the Republicans, particularly by the RNC, Republican National Committee Chairman Ed Gillespie, to refer simply to speech that expresses intense dislike or hatred for President Bush. So calling President Bush a miserable failure, for example, is described by the RNC as hate speech, though that's clearly not what the word originally meant. President Bush, in his State of the Union address, talked about release. I'm sure if they've got the wording exactly right, but it was about discrimination against persons of faith. This in reference to his faith-based initiative programs. Now, discrimination, again, is a word that is traditionally associated with the left and the civil rights movement, but is taken over in this Ottawa. I mean, you could say that, in fact, the Constitution does discriminate against establishments of religion, but nobody would have put it in those terms. And, in fact, the word you used at the very end, a biased, is another word that it's been around in the language for a long time, but it acquired a particular sense and use during the civil rights movement. And it was the right who appropriated that sense of bias in applying it to what they call the liberal bias of the press. So this is a very common process. I keep thinking about Bush described Senator Santorum as a very inclusive man. An interesting remark. But also using an adjective that he wouldn't have used, a Republican wouldn't have used 15 or 20 years ago. So there is certainly that process whereby the language is introduced on the left, acquires a certain moral meaning, and then is moved over or appropriated or neutralized by the right.
Is there any particular reason it's so one-directional? It seems like it would be a more natural exchange.
Well, I think for one reason, this begins in a certain sense in Vietnam and during the civil rights movement, when both the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement ultimately acquired a certain moral luster that Republicans were in some way, conservatives, I should say, really, were in some way forced to acknowledge. And that's why you'll find conservatives using, for example, phrases from the civil rights movement like colorblind, for example, or a phrase Bush likes, the soft racism of inadequate expectations or insufficient expectations. That's part of the process. But, something else has happened in the same way. I mean, the values is a very interesting word, which it did have its origin more or less on the left. It was one of those trendy social science words in the 1950s. It was the kind of word that you'd see in a Jules Feiffer column, if you still remember Jules Feiffer columns. It was adopted by the Republicans in the late 60s, early 70s, Spiro Agnew and people like that, and became a kind of shorthand for middle American religious-based principles or morals to the point where if you do a search now in the newspapers, and I'm not talking just about the conservative papers, but even in the New York Times and the Washington Post, those so-called liberal bastions, you'll find that the phrase conservative values is about four times as common as the phrase liberal values. Now, this is something that Democrats have, particularly over the last campaign, the primary campaigns, been trying to reverse. So you'll hear Democrats using the word values. You'll hear Democrats using words like moral scandal and the like, morality, in very self-conscious ways that are intended to neutralize the implicit tilt that's present in those words.
Is it that the liberals or the Democrats just haven't been as good as getting their language out there, or is something else going, or is the media just so overwhelmingly conservative that it ends up being this way?
Well, I think to a certain extent the Democrats have been behind the curve on this. The Republicans, particularly since the late 80s, have been very skillful at coining language that either puts their program in terms that most people can understand, whereas the Democrats have this weakness for wonkery that shows up in their language, or at neutralizing, as I say, taking over terms like inclusiveness and discrimination and colorblindness and so on, and hate speech, and redeploying them in the service of conservative doctrines, and that's something that they. Democrats have been just less skillful at doing. I think the idea of the media having a liberal bias or a conservative bias, I mean, there certainly are media that are explicitly directed one way and the other. But I think, in fact, that a lot of what's called bias in the media really reflects underlying assumptions that a lot of us have. And in fact, take this point about the fact that the media, even the New York Times and the Washington Post, use the phrase conservative values many times more often than they use the phrase liberal values. Now, that certainly wouldn't betray a conservative bias at the Times or the Post. It's more a question of this just sort of being steeped in the culture to the point where nobody even recognizes the implications that are implicit in using one or another word.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. Let's go on to another listener now, listener in Urbana, line three. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to get back to that phrase, Homeland Security, and just say that I was really astonished when they developed that phrase to describe the program, because to me, the word homeland is reminiscent of nothing so much as the use of the word fatherland, you know, in the 30s in Germany, and it just seemed like a really bad choice to me. I'm surprised no one has made that connection. So that's a comment. The other thing I wanted to say was I've also been astonished at how adept this administration seems to be at saying things that aren't true, but saying them enough that people begin to believe them. A good example is the on the connection, of which there is none between, or seemingly none between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and yet a very large percentage of the American public seems to think there is a connection simply because the Republicans have said so many times or implied so many times that that is the case. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that phenomenon of just creating a reality by repeating untruths often enough until it becomes a reality. I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, on the first point, I actually, as I think I mentioned, have a piece in here about that phrase homeland, and did that make that connection? It really does. It's, you know, that the Ukrainian Germans, the Italians, the Syrians, they have homelands. We just have this flag and this song. On the second point about the connection that people draw between terrorists and say Saddam Hussein's regime, I think that's a very important point. It's certainly not one that's entirely or perhaps even chiefly conveyed by language, but this, the point that another caller was making about the way terrorist is used very loosely to refer to, for instance, all the different groups that we find ourselves combating in Iraq, certainly contributes to that, so that some of those people are no doubt terrorists on the Al-Qaeda model. Some of them maybe are former Baathists. Others are just Iraqis who are annoyed and angry about the American occupation. Lots of different motivations for those people, but they all get lumped together as terrorists in a certain sense that, as you say, blurs the difference between the groups who can reasonably be described as perpetrators of 9/11 and these other groups that have sort of come under the anti-terrorist umbrella.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
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 I want to make a couple of comments. First of all, I remember President Bush actually visited Britain a few months back, a little while ago, and I remember that he actually pronounced the word nuclear correctly when he was in Britain. And I also remember that most of the NPR pundits at the time just were just overjoyed.
You know, I'll have to look that up. I've actually been looking to see if he ever uses the word correctly. I've been going to the WhiteHouse.gov website to see if he ever refers to something like nuclear medicine or nuclear family in a speech that has a audio file up, so I could find out if he pronounced it right in those words. So if he did say it correctly in Britain, that's interesting. But, you know, it's not that surprising. I mean, his dad said it correctly. He grew up sitting around a supper table in Kennebunkport.
By the way, I'm sure,
yep,
that was completely and totally intentional and planned. I'm sure they actually have meetings, at least short meetings, where they discuss how they're going to pronounce that word. I have no doubt, not a shadow of a doubt in my mind, that it was intentional, and they said, well, you know, Mr. President, there's not as many rednecks in Britain as there are in America, and that's exactly the reason it was done.
Well, I suppose it could be that. It could simply be that when Americans get to Britain, they feel they have to be on their linguistic best behavior. The fact is that Bush knows very well how the word should be pronounced. As I say, he grew up hearing it pronounced properly from his father. He went to Andover, he went to Yale, hearing it pronounced properly. He isn't like President Eisenhower, who came to this word in middle age when it was a relatively new word and never quite got it right. So in his case, I think it's definitely a choice, whether it's the kind of deliberate choice you're suggesting or whether it's just the kind of unconscious choice we all make when we clean up our grammar in certain contexts and not others.
Okay, well, I do remember that he definitely did that, and I also remember that all of the pundits on NPR were just could hardly believe their ears, and they just thought it was the most wonderful thing in the world.
I'll have to check it and see if there's an audio file available on it.
Do I have a couple time for a little more?
I have another caller waiting. So
okay,
what do you say we go ahead and take the next call?
All right, thanks a lot.
Okay, well, thanks for your call. We talk next with a listener in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Yeah, line two. Well, this is quite interesting. As long as we're doing semantics, we might take up the question of working class and middle class and class consciousness, because at least in my view of things, it is the middle class consciousness of the working class that is responsible, that is to say, the SUV mentality, for supporting all of the right-wing politics that are going on right now. And we have to bear in mind, too, of course, that Karl Marx said that the only class-conscious class was the bourgeoisie. Have fun with this one. I'll let you go. I'm anxious for your answer. Thanks.
Okay. There's a piece in the book.
Yeah, as it happens, there's a piece in this book called Class Dismissed, where I go through some of the issues involving that incredibly complicated word class in American society. I began by listing it shortly after the second set of tax cuts was proposed. There's this sharp spike in the use of class warfare in the press, and I thought, I wonder if you go back and look to see when that phrase peaks, what are you going to find? And sure enough, class warfare always peaks when Republicans are getting after Democrats for attacking their tax proposals. And it's an indication of how that word is used, particularly by the right, in American political conversation. I mean, one important point is this: that we have a notion of a working class, which you won't hear much in political speech. It doesn't occur at all, for instance, in the WhiteHouse.gov press releases. You only see working people or working families. We have middle class that covers just about everybody else. And then in theory we have this term upper class, but that's a term that for us really denotes a social elite rather than an economically powerful group. I mean, you say upper class, you think of Thurston Howell, you don't think of somebody like Jack Welch. In fact, I'm sure if you talk to Welch, the former CEO of General Electric, who was making however many tens of millions a year, if you asked him, what class are you, he would say, oh, I'm middle class, and pointed to the fact that he drinks long neck beer and not Chardonnay. It's become a matter of consumption, not income. And for that reason, when the Republicans raise the specter of class warfare, what comes to mind is a kind of warfare between the working class or the underclass and the vast number of Americans who think of themselves as middle class. Because a middle class or a school principal, say, making $80,000 a year, doesn't think of herself as belonging to a different class from Jack Welch, but she may very well think of herself as belonging from a different class from the school janitor. And for that reason, the only class distinction in America is the one between the working class, or the underclass, and this vast, diffuse group that calls itself the middle class. And that's the ability to promote and perpetuate that conception of class has been very important in American political life.
Maybe you would also talk about the essay that you wrote, Keeping Ahead of the Joneses, and your thoughts about the meritocracy.
Yeah, that was a fun piece to write. I was going to dig it out very quickly as I vamp. The occasion for it was the affair in New York where a now former Citicorp executive had Citicorp donate $1 million to a very prestigious preschool in order to get his kid into preschool. And I began to think about that prefix pre and the way it works in American discourse, to the point where we have I'm looking for the piece now even as I speak.
Yeah, it's on page 8. It begins on page 8.
Page 8, it's right at the beginning there.
Yeah. One of my favorite lines from this piece, though, is about the passengers who pre-board for first class. It's like telling someone, well, they're pre-boarding because they've been selected because they look as if they'd make the best use of the champagne.
Right. There's a sense of privilege.
Not because they paid more.
Right. Well, yeah. You know, pre is all over the place now. We pre-book our rooms at a hotel. It was always, I suppose, preferable to post-booking them. And as I say in the piece, at the airport gate, they announce pre-boarding, and the VIPs and first-class passengers are already getting on the plane. And there is a sense, the prefix in a certain way collapses the difference between privilege and the meritocratic values that we like to think determine who gets on the airplane, who gets into the preschool, who gets into college, and so forth.
You've got to buy, not B-Y-E, but B-U-Y.
B-U-Y, right. As I said in the piece, what's clear is opportunity in America is increasingly a matter of getting an early jump on things, of pre-testing, pre-selection, pre-approval, pre-admission, and not to be coy about it, pre-payment. In a certain sense, that could stand in for the failure, or at least the disappointment of American meritocracy. Nick Lemon, in a book, The Big Test, he really suggested that the meritocratic system began to unravel when it ceased to be aimed at picking the best people for public service and became rather a matter of a question of deciding how to hand out the goodies. And to the extent that all this privilege is wrapped in the language of meritocracy, that's where you begin to see the hypocrisy. This kid applying to this preschool in New York, when this kid did that, the director of the preschool said, "No, Garrett, no child is guaranteed admission here. Every child goes through the same rigorous admissions process." Well, if that were the case, then all of these little Schiffs and Warburgs and Rockefellers and Citicorp executives' children who were going to the school were picked simply because of their superior merit rather than because their parents were in a position to donate large amounts of money to the school. And in a certain sense, that is, as you say, as if the passengers who get to fly in first class were picked because they'll make better use of the champagne rather than because they paid more for their ticket.
Let's talk with another listener. Line one, Urbana.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
The other thing I wanted to bring up was pre-owned.
Pre-owned.
Instead of used.
And I remember when that went through, and I was looking through the paper going, no.
We have another word for that.
It's a used car.
Right. Pre-owned, pre-approved.
Right.
You know, I keep thinking of the junk mail I get in my mailbox every other day. You may already be a winner.
Yeah, that's right. And then just the general dumbing down of things, and like you were talking about lumping things together, as far as liberal and conservative.
Mm-hmm.
You remember when it was possible to be a conservative Democrat or a liberal Republican, and there were four basic categories?
You know, that's true, and I actually did, nowadays with these huge newspaper databases online, you actually find out what's happening to those phrases.
Yeah.
And I looked at those, and it turns out you're absolutely right. The occurrence of conservative Democrat, that phrase is only about a third as common as it was 20 years ago. Yeah. And liberal Republican has almost vanished. As soon as Senator Chafee leaves his seat in Rhode Island, the word will be permanently banished.
And then just one last comment, based on something a previous caller had said, the selection of the phrase homeland security. Everybody that I run around with, most, or not everybody, but the vast majority, when it was coming, had come out that they were considering using this phrase, and we all went, "Oh, no." And it was immediately associated by, "May I see your papers, please?" and the clicking of boot heels.
Yeah, I think a lot of people had that feeling. I certainly did. And I figured, they're going to stick it on the name of this department, and once that happens, it's going to be used in that way in bureaucratic context. But nobody's actually going to talk about America as the homeland. And sure enough, I'm hearing politicians, I heard Bush not long ago talk about protecting the homeland. And it struck me as an absurd usage, but one that, for some reason, Republicans in particular feel very comfortable with.
Well, we've got one last caller to talk with this afternoon, and let's quickly go and get this last person in, a listener in Champaign, line two. Go ahead.
When Bush is trying to convince us that what happened in this prison, Abu Ghraib, in Iraq, he always says this horrific behavior by American GIs was un-American. As an African-American who grew up in the South, and now thinking about Emmett Till and the Little Rock Nine and all the other horrendous acts, what is un-American?
Well, and that's an interesting point. I mean, there's a sense in which the effort is to make this stuff seem alien and foreign and distant, as if Americans couldn't be responsible for that. You know, it's very interesting because there's a group of people on the right, not just Rush Limbaugh, but Mitch Dechter, the conservative neoconservative commentator, who have been trying to liken this to fraternity hazing. Dechter used the word hazing in an L.A. Times opinion piece last weekend, and Limbaugh's been going around saying, oh, he's just blowing off some steam. Literally, he said that. This is no worse than the initiation to Skull and Bones at Yale. Now, that's a grotesque comparison to make. I mean, it isn't as if these people, the detainees, were being asked to join a club or were in a position to walk out the door if they decided they didn't want to join the club. It would be like using hazing of what the L.A. police did to Rodney King. But there's one thing about it that struck me. When you call it hazing, which I agree is a dreadful name for it, you're at least admitting that it's something that ordinary American adolescents might do. And that in some sense it's not alien and exotic and, as you say, un-American. It's something that can be quite American and that runs in a certain line of, let me call it, sadistic play. That's a very common feature of American life and that can very easily slip over into genuine abuse and maltreatment and worse. So, yeah, I agree with you.
We have to stop there. We're out of time. Jeffrey Nunberg, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Jeffrey Nunberg, his essays on language and words have been collected in a book just out from Public Affairs Press, Going Nuclear, N-U-C-U-L-A-R, Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. At the Chicago Board of Trade, after imploding yesterday in the bean pit, futures managed to bounce back today, up 21 cents, 21 and a half in the nearby May contract. The July on out, July, for all intents and purposes, really the lead option at the moment, at least until that May expires tomorrow. The July up anywhere around 10 cents for the day, and those all settled up near their high. So we'll get to those numbers and take a look at them in just a bit. We'll talk also with Dan Zwicker of Agri Services in Bloomington, Illinois, about what technically has happened in the marketplace this week, how much damage might have been done to the charts yesterday, especially in the bean pit. Let's start with the May wheat for the day, 366.5, the high, the low at 360, settled 362.25. They were up a quarter of a cent. July futures down a quarter, 373.5, the high, low at 365, settled 369.25. September contract, 380, high, low at 372, settled 376, they were up a quarter. And December futures in the wheat pit, 390, the high, the low at 382.5, settled 386.25, up a quarter. The March contract for 2005, 394.5, high, low at 388, settled 392, unchanged for the March wheat. From the corn pit, the nearby May contract, 294, the high, the low at 287.75, settled 289.75, down 4.75. And July, 298.5, high, low at 293, settled 295.25. Off the board, or rather off, settled the day, down 2.25. September corn futures, 293.75, the high, the low at 288.75, settled 291.25, a penny and 3/4 lower. And December contract, 291.75 high, low at 286. A settlement price for the Deese corn, 289.5. They were down 1.25 on the day. March futures, 1.25 lower as well, 296, the high, the low at 291.25. March settled 294. May contract in the corn pit, 299, the high, the low at 294.5. May 2005 corn settled 297.5, down 1. And the July futures, 298.75 high, low at 294, settled 296.5, down 1. December corn, 2005, 274.5, the high, the low at 268, settled 269.5.5 lower. From the oat pit, the May contract at 153.5 high, low at 152.5, settled 152.5, down 4.5. July oats, 161, the high, the low at 156, settled 157.5, down 3.25 for the day. From the soy complex, the nearby May contract staging a rally today. 10.14 the high, the low at 9.87. Settled 10.13, just a penny off the high at 21.5 cents higher. July futures 9.85 the high, the low at 9.62. Settled 9.82 1/2, and they were up 10.25. And the August soybeans 9.19 1/2 the high, the low at 9.01. Settled 9.17 3/4, up 13.25. September futures for the beans, 7.94 the high, the low at 7.78 1/2, settled 7.92 1/2, up 9.5. In the November contract, harvest month, 7.40 1/2 the high, the low at 7.25, settled 7.36, up 5.5 cents for the day. January soybeans were up 6, 7.41 the high, the low at 7.30, settled 7.38 1/2. And the March contract, 6.5 higher, 7.33 the high, the low at 7.25, settled 7.32. From the bean meal pit, 3.25 the high for the May contract, the low at 3.14, settled 3.24.50. They were up 105. And July futures, 3.16.50 the high, the low at 3.08, settled 3.16, and they were up 7 even. The May contract, by the way, up 10.50, not 105. May bean oil for the day, 31.65 the high, the low at 31.08, settled 31.65, and they were up 10. July futures, 31.30 the high, the low at 30.63, settled 31.13, unchanged on the day. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. May feeder cattle, the high today 102.90, the low 102.30, the settlement 102.80, that up 12.5. August, $100.05, the high, the low 99.20, the settlement 99.60, that down 5. September feeder cattle, 98.85, the high 98.10, the low 98.40, the settlement, that down 10. June live cattle, 82.95, the high 82 even, the low 82.12 1/2, the settlement, that down 65. August live cattle, 84.90, the high 84.10, the low 84.27 1/2, the settlement, that down 82 1/2. May lean hogs, 82.70, the high 82.15, the low 82.25, the settlement, that unchanged. June, 75.95, the high 74.80, the low 75.90, the settlement, that up 72 1/2. July lean hogs, 75.80, the high 74.85, the low 75.45, the settlement, that down 17 1/2. August, 73 even, the high 72 even, the low 72.92 1/2, the settlement, that up 22 1/2. And May pork bellies, 123.35, the high 121 even, the low, the settlement 123.30, that up 110. The Dow down 51 points at 99.94. The NASDAQ is off 1 point at 1924. The S&P 3 lower at 1094.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau, whose mission is to improve the economic well-being of agriculture and enrich the quality of farm family life.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Ian and Maddie Farrar, ages 5 and 4, from Colorado Springs, Colorado, write, "Dear Dr. Science, why do my fingers and toes wrinkle in the bathtub, but not the rest of me?"
The rest of you is already wrinkled to capacity. Happily, our toes and fingers are still wrinkleable. Yes, like the saggy, baggy elephant. We humans are a hideous composite of wrinkles, stretch marks, and sags. Scientists are working on the problem.